Today's Wednesday, December 8th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, the U.S. and Russia agreed to continue diplomatic options to de-escalate tension over Ukraine.
President and President Putin agreed that our teams will follow up on the issues discussed. The President and his European colleagues agreed that our teams will work together to ensure that our engagement with Russia going forward.
Plus, the WHO warns against the use of convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19.
The head of the World Health Organization's Clinical Care Emergencies Program, Janet Diaz, says some of these studies have shown different results in the efficacy of this treatment.
Also, India's top military commander killed in a helicopter crash. Our top story today is in the U.S. The U.S. and Russia agreed to continue diplomatic options to de-escalate tension in Ukraine. President Joe Biden warned Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday the West would impose, quote, strong economic and other measures, unquote, on Russia if it invades Ukraine, while Putin demanded guarantees NATO would not expand further eastward. The two leaders spoke for 2 hours over a video link about Ukraine and other disputes. U.S.-Russian relations have sunk to their lowest point since the end of the Cold War more than 3 decades ago. Diplomatic analysts have said sanctions, which could target Russia's banks and Moscow's ability to convert rubles into other currencies, are designed to dissuade Putin from using tens of thousands of troops massed near the Ukrainian border to attack its neighbor. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters after the call, the United States and European allies would provide additional defensive capabilities to Ukraine, as well as beef up NATO allies in the region.
The President and President Putin agreed that our teams will follow up on the issues discussed. The President, his European colleagues agreed that our teams will work together to ensure that our engagement with Russia going forward both involves and is closely coordinated with European allies and partners so that we are all on the same page. There's a lot of work to do in the days ahead. As we pursue diplomatic channels, we will also prepare for all contingencies, just as we have been doing for weeks now, including through the preparation of specific responses to Russian escalation should they be required. Specific, robust, clear responses should they be required. In the event that there is a further invasion into Ukraine, a military escalation in Ukraine, obviously many of our partners on the Eastern Front, Baltic allies, Romania, Poland, other countries, will be increasingly concerned about the security and territorial integrity of their countries. They will be seeking, we expect, additional capabilities and potentially additional deployments, and the United States will be looking to respond positively to those things in the event that there is a further incursion into Ukraine. We still do not believe that President Putin has made a decision. What President Biden did lay out very clearly the consequences if he chooses to move. As President Biden looked President Putin in the eye and told him that things we did not do in 2014, we are prepared to do now.
That's U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The Kremlin said on Tuesday it expected no immediate breakthroughs in strained U.S.-Russia relations after President Vladimir Putin held virtual talks with Joe Biden, but said the two leaders would keep engaging on practical matters. Quote, it's hard to expect any sudden breakthroughs, but the presidents demonstrated their willingness to continue practical work and begin discussing sensitive issues that seriously concern Moscow, unquote, Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov said. Ushakov said the two leaders had not discussed a proposal to meet in person or neutral territory, despite having previously considered the idea. Reuters reports that U.S. officials have told members of Congress they have an understanding with Germany about shutting down the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline if Russia invades Ukraine. The White House said Germany had made commitments about the pipeline, which runs from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea in the event of aggression acts by Russia. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the United States had been in touch with the outgoing and incoming German governments about Nord Stream 2 in the context of a potential invasion. He declined to characterize the conversations further. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
When it comes to Nord Stream 2, the fact is the gas is not currently flowing through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which means that it's not operating, which means that it's not leverage for Putin. Indeed, it is a leverage for the West, because if Vladimir Putin wants to see gas flow through that pipeline, he may not want to take the risk of invading Ukraine. That the subject of the future of Nord Stream 2 in the context of an invasion of Ukraine by Russia in the coming weeks is a topic of utmost priority. We've had intensive discussions with both the outgoing and incoming German governments on the issue of Nord Stream 2 in the context of a potential invasion. I'm not going to characterize it beyond that, other than it is an object of great priority.
That's U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Olaf Scholz has become Germany's ninth post-World War II chancellor, opening a new era for the European Union's most populous nation and largest economy after Angela Merkel's 16-year tenure. Scholz's government takes office with hopes of modernizing Germany and combating climate change, but faces the immediate challenge of handling the country's toughest phase yet of the coronavirus pandemic. Lawmakers voted by 395 to 303 with six abstentions to elect Scholz. Scholz exchanged fist bumps from lawmakers from across the political spectrum before German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier formally appointed him chancellor. Indian officials have confirmed the country's top military commander, the Chief of Defense Staff Bipin Rawat, was killed in a helicopter crash Wednesday. He was among 14 people on board a helicopter that crashed in southern Tamil Nadu state. The senior civilian administrator of the area where the crash took place says rescuers were able to save one male passenger who was taken to a hospital for treatment. Television images from the crash site showed plumes of smoke billowing from the debris as local residents tried to put out the fire and remove bodies from the wreckage. Israel's defense minister and Mossad chief travels to Washington this week for talks about the renewed and now stalled Iran nuclear negotiations. Israeli officials warn that they will act alone if world powers fail to stop Iran from maintaining nuclear weapons. This includes developing military capabilities and continuing the ongoing cyber war between Israel and Iran. Linda Grandstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
As international diplomats struggle to renew negotiations on the Iran nuclear deal, Israeli officials are taking a hard line against Iran and working to persuade the West to take the same approach. Since the Trump administration withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, Iran has breached many restrictions under the pact designed to slow down Tehran's ability to make nuclear weapons. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, recently published reports showing that Iran has significantly accelerated its nuclear program. Many Israeli analysts are concerned that Iran's nuclear program will not be reversed and will continue to advance. Reports say Israel has approved a budget of $1.5 billion to prepare for a military strike against Iran. Analysts say the strike would be difficult for Israel to achieve on its own because Iran's nuclear facilities are dispersed among at least five separate sites, some of them deep underground. But Israelis believe that a credible military option is necessary for deterrence in negotiations with Iran. In addition to the military option, Israel is continuing to pressure Iran in the cyber arena. News reports say Israel has launched a series of cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear program and civilian infrastructure, while Iran is suspected in recent cyber attacks against the Israeli water system and technology companies. Talks to revive the deal broke off last week amid new Iranian demands that reportedly backtrack on the previous agreement. Israeli officials are pushing the U.S. to affirm that there is a military option for confronting Iran. The Biden administration has stated that they are working to revive the diplomatic process, although they acknowledge that Iran does not appear to be serious about the negotiations. In the meantime, Israel plans to continue building up its military and cyber deterrence capabilities. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The World Health Organization says convalescent plasma does not prevent people from dying from COVID-19 and advises against its use. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Various studies over time have been conducted to see whether convalescent plasma, that is, the transfusion of blood plasma from someone who has recovered from COVID-19, can save the lives of people newly infected with the deadly disease. The head of the World Health Organization's Clinical Care Emergencies Program, Janet Diaz, says some of these studies have shown different results in the efficacy of this treatment.
But when we look at the totality of the evidence, so not just individual trials, but bring it all together, the certainty in the non-severe patients, so those mild patients, is pretty high to moderate that it does not have an important impact on mortality.
Diaz says clinical experts in different fields of medicine have issued new guidelines on the the use of convalescent plasma. She says they are based on evidence gathered from 16 clinical trials involving more than 16,000 patients with non-severe, severe, and critical COVID-19 infections. As such, she says WHO strongly recommends against the use of convalescent plasma for the treatment of non-severe COVID-19. Current high certainty evidence, she says, shows it does not result in an important reduction in mortality.
The second recommendation is a recommendation against the use of convalescent plasma in patients with severe and critical COVID-19 outside of clinical trials. This is based on low certainty evidence that convalescent plasma may have little or no impact on mortality.
Diaz notes uncertainty remains about the potential benefits of convalescent plasma among people who are critically ill with COVID-19. Therefore, she says, the panel of experts thinks it's important to continue clinical trials in the use of this treatment for this category of patients. Such carefully monitored, ethically structured trials, she adds, would help generate more evidence on the actual effects of this treatment among severely ill patients. In February, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration scaled back its convalescent plasma emergency use authorization based on the results of clinical trials. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Living through a pandemic has been a stressful and difficult challenge. Divisions between the vaccinated and unvaccinated have made the past year even more stressful. Karen Ambafrizian reports on both sides and efforts to change minds.
Sometime over the past 2 years, getting a COVID vaccine became a huge point of conflict between Americans. There are websites devoted to shaming people who refuse the vaccine, only to become seriously ill or die from the disease. And there have been reported threats of violence leveled against vaccine advocates and public health experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci. Digging past politics, the fact remains that COVID hits the unvaccinated the hardest, but that fact doesn't seem to be registering. Pier Carlo Valdesolo is an associate professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College.
What we're seeing with the virus is a highly politicized topic, stoking in-group, out-group sentiments. And one of the dominant ways that people react emotionally to the suffering of out-group members is a muted sense of empathy and, at the extreme, even a sense of pleasure in the pain of out-group members.
Retired Maryland resident Linda Mercer was initially against getting a COVID-19 vaccine. She says her concern rose from the speed with which the vaccine was developed, and relatives and former colleagues shared her skepticism. But that changed in the middle of 2021, when Mercer got the virus. Mercer spent a few weeks in hospital. After she recovered, she and her family got the vaccine.
It made me say, okay, get the vaccine, because if the vaccine could just save you from getting as sick as I did, I'd rather have the vaccine than to catch COVID again.
Experts say Mercer's story shows how vaccine opponents can change the minds of others with similar views.
At least from a psychological perspective, it makes sense that anti-vaxxers would be more compelled by the story of an individual in-group member who is suffering than reading news stories about how many people are dying of COVID every day or how effective a vaccine is.
A study at Brigham Young University suggests that personal stories do more to encourage vaccinations than faceless statistics. In an experiment, students who opposed the vaccine interviewed people who got illnesses that could have been prevented with a vaccine. By the end, roughly 70% of students had changed their mind about vaccinations. Experts say this suggests that education does more to change attitudes about vaccines than does public shaming. For Karina Bafrajan in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Doctors Without Borders, also known as Médecins Sans Frontières, calling for local integration and resettlement of refugees living in the Dadaab camp ahead of the Kenyan government's deadline for closing the camp. In a report released Tuesday, the aid organization calls on Kenya and its international partners to live up to the commitments made in the 2018 Global Compact on Refugees
and allow Somali refugees to integrate into Kenyan society or be resettled abroad instead of being forced back to Somalia. While Dadaab is no longer the largest refugee camp in the world, it is still home to an approximately 232,903 refugees, many of whom were born in the camps. Abigail Lukwara is advocacy manager for MSF. She says conditions in the camp are deteriorating.
The humanitarian assistance has been going down, and most of the refugees are really struggling to make ends meet because they are confined in camps and they cannot sustain themselves because they can't seek for employment elsewhere, and they have very limited opportunities, basically. WFP reduced their food ration to 52% of the required ration.
The government of Kenya says it is still going ahead to close the camp. What are the options for those who are currently in the camp?
The first option is the voluntary repatriation, which is going to be very tricky for Somali refugees because this has been going down for quite a number of years. Like last year alone, they repatriated less than 200 people. So you can imagine a population of 200,000. So voluntary repatriation is nearly out of question for most of these Somali refugees. The other proposed solution was resettlement in third countries and complementary pathways, which also has gone down because the countries that are supposed to offer the opportunities are no longer offering the opportunities as required. They are having all their own crisis in terms of refugees from other countries as well. So there are very limited opportunities for resettlement and complementary pathways for these refugees. The third option was integration into the local community, which is a more viable solution. But this is not very clear when it comes to Somali refugees as compared to refugees who are from East African communities. So basically that leaves Somali refugees with very few options.
Are there other feasible options that you are working or talking with the government about?
We don't have other options that we are talking to the government about. The only thing we are trying to lobby and advocate for is for refugees to be given a voice on deciding what works for them. Because the solutions proposed cannot apply to everyone, considering the different categories of refugees and their different needs. And we all know the situation in Somalia is not yet stable. There is no clear way of even continuity for care for people who are living with lifelong conditions. So the idea is the camp should not be closed. As much as we don't like the camp idea, because it's been 30 years and people cannot be living in the camp. But refugees need time to be economically empowered, to be self-reliant and to be resilient, so that now they can stand on their own. And even if they're being integrated in the community, it should be a stepwise process. So this is what we are trying to lobby for.
What are the likely consequences if the government goes ahead to close the camp and there are no options for the refugees?
This is going to leave the refugees in a more vulnerable position of exploitation from authorities, exploitation from the local community. And most of them might be forced to go back to Somalia amidst the situation that is there, which will expose them even to higher risk and creating maybe another crisis in Somalia.
What are your fears about the conditions in the camp, the uncertainty of the fate of the refugees, and the reluctance of the Kenyan government to go back on its decision to close the camp?
We all agree with Kenyan government, camps are not a solution. What we are looking at is how can the international community partner with Kenya to provide durable solutions for refugees? And these durable solutions include having development projects for the host communities of refugees to be able to empower the host community and the refugees to integrate within those communities. Also for Kenya to be a bit flexible with refugees to help them move around, to do business, to seek medical care, because some of them can afford that medical care, but they are in closing camps and they can't move out of the camp, so they can't seek specialized care. So some of the things we are looking at is how can government at least ease on some of those restrictions they have put on refugees so that they are not held hostage. They are not in a state of limbo where they don't know, they don't have any plans for tomorrow because they are in camps. They are confined in a designated area.
That's Abigail Luwara, Advocacy Manager for MSF, speaking with me from Nairobi. This is the Voice of America. Australia's Prime Minister says his country will join the US in a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics over human rights concerns. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says it should come as no surprise that Australian officials would boycott the event after the nation's relationship with China had broken down in recent years. He says Australian athletes will still be able to compete. China responded furiously, saying no Australian officials have been invited to the Olympics and, quote, no one would care about whether they come or not, unquote. French authorities have announced that an arrested man thought to be linked to the 2018 killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was misidentified. The Paris General Prosecutor's Office issued a short statement Wednesday after over 24 hours of checks. It said the man arrested Tuesday at an airport was not Khalid Ayed al-Otaibi, who is wanted under a 2019 Turkish arrest warrant. French media reported that the mix-up was related to the fact that the detained man had the same name. A judicial official told the Associated Press the suspect can be held until Thursday morning, but he will likely be released before. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Two computer scientists at the University of Maryland have developed a new artificial intelligence system that evolves to detect and evade internet censorship in repressive countries. BOA's Julie Tabor has more.
Repressive governments around the world monitor and control internet traffic being sent and received by their citizens. Attempts to evade such censorship is a slow and cumbersome process. Often, researchers must manually search for ways to circumvent it.
Now we understand that these different countries will use a heterogeneous mix of different devices.
But computer scientists at the University of Maryland have developed artificial intelligence software called Geneva that learns how censoring technology is being used and adjusts in real time to circumvent it.
I think Geneva changes this cat and mouse game because it finally allows the evaders to react very, very quickly to changes in censorship.
Information on the internet is broken into data packets by the sender's computer and reassembled by the receiving computer. Repressive regimes monitor the data packets and block requests that either contain flagged words or prohibited domain names. Geneva automatically evolves to circumvent this type of censorship in a couple of ways.
One way, it might make the censor think, oh, this isn't something that needs to be censored. This is fine. I'll let it happen. Or it tricks the censor into thinking that it did tear down the connection, that it stopped the communication, when in fact it didn't really.
For example,
about a year ago, China deployed a totally new censorship system to try and interrupt specific types of secure communications, and took our software only about an hour to come up with ways to defeat it.
What's more, users don't have to install Geneva. It can run on the background of a web browser.
This was very important to us because it means that people can evade censorship without having to take on any danger of installing anti-censorship software in the first place.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, College Park, Maryland.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has apologized and ordered an inquiry after a leaked video showed senior members of his party joking about holding a lockdown-breaching Christmas party. The video has poured fuel on allegations that government officials flouted coronavirus rules they imposed on everyone else. Johnson said that, quote, I understand and share the anger, quote, at staff seeming to make light of lockdown rules. A video aired by broadcaster ITV showed then-Press Secretary Allegra Stratton appearing to joke about an illicit party at the Prime Minister's Downing Street office. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokwe Yabaro, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays,